Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Whisper and Thunder Radio. Tonight's episode is on sexual assault and domestic violence in Indian Country. Because April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we've dedicated tonight to talking about those issues, but limiting it to Indian Country. We know that in one of every six women has been the victim of a rape or an attempted rape in her lifetime, and domestic violence is the leading cause of injuries in women ages 15 to 44. So we have a great show for you this evening. We hope that you'll stay tuned for the whole show. Our lead hosts are Billy Fidlin, the chairman of Whisper and Thunder, and Rebecca Blaylog. I am so sorry I'm having such a hard time speaking this evening. She's the co-chair of our board, and the episode on sexual assault and domestic violence in Indian Country will be an archive for some time. If you missed it on live, you can always come back, or if you have to leave, you can come back and listen to us later. Hey, everybody, our WINS scholarship applications are due by May 1st. The Whisper and Thunder WINS Scholarship is a program that covers any Native American or First Nations student of any age, provided they're a student of good standing enrolled in vocational college or university study, and the scholarship is awarded on a one-time basis. So the scholarships are due May 1st. I mean, the applications are due May 1st, and the first week of June is when they will be announced. We started out in 2010 with one recipient of a scholarship, increased that to two in 2011, three in 2012, and I believe we're up to four or five in 2013. So get those applications in. You can find them on our website, www.whisperandthunder.org/WNT WIN Scholarship HTML. On the right hand side, about 10 up from the bottom on the right list, you will see the Whisper and Thunder WINS application, and you can click on that link and submit it online. So be sure and get those in before May 1st in order to get your scholarship application in on time and get consideration. So without further ado, I'm going to open the mic to our board chairman and vice chair, Rebecca Blaylog and Billy Fidlin, and I am going to wish them a wonderful show, and I'm here in the background to help, and you ladies, here you go. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda, so much. And before I forget, I do want to acknowledge and say thank you to Brenda, who is our executive producer for WNT Radio, and the rest of the team, Russ Litica, who is our co-producer, and Claudia Julien, who will be managing our chat room tonight. This is Billy Fidlin, and I'm president of Whisper and Thunder. Friends, I want to extend a cautionary note to our listeners this evening. Some of what we discuss, it may be sensitive. It may hit a nerve with you, and we want you to know that our hearts are with you, and we understand as much as we possibly can. One of the things that has been such an honor as president of our organization, of Whisper and Thunder, has been to develop an amazing board of directors. So tonight on air with me, I do have our vice president. Her name is Rebecca Blaylog, and she is not only the vice president, she's also chair of our ERES fund, and she certainly is my right arm. But I have to tell you, her greatest impact, beyond being the best mom on the planet, has been with her work in domestic violence, which is, if you will, her vocation, her day job. So I'd like to welcome Rebecca this evening, who will walk this journey this evening with all of us tonight. Good evening, Beck.
Hi. Thank you, Billy. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for that very nice introduction. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, friend. We're going to frame this evening with a conversation with a friend of ours, with a friend of Whisper and Thunder. He's a supporter of ours. I will call him Bill. You know, domestic violence and sexual assault, it is not only a women's issue. And the fact is, and Rebecca, you may need to help me with the statistic, but I know that, you know, within recent years, the statistic has been one in five men experience this devastating happening as well. We thought that we would frame this evening by hearing just a little bit about Bill's story, and then we're going to move into the issues that face Indian Country. Bill, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing good, Billy. It's nice to hear your voice.
Well, good to hear you, and we want to thank you. I know on behalf of Beck and myself, we want to thank you for the courage that you have to be with us tonight. So I would like to open, just if you could just give us a glimpse of what you have been through.
Sure. I was raped as a child starting at age lasting up through 8 or 9. It started in the late 40s and ended probably in the early 50s. It included first my uncle, then my mother, then my grandfather, and finally a Catholic priest and some of his friends. I ended up extremely depressed because of all of this as an adult and didn't really start any healing until about 1999 when I started reading books about depression. And one of the things the books mentioned was post-traumatic stress disorder. So I got books about post-traumatic stress disorder, and that was me. Those were the symptoms that I was suffering from. And there were, of course, many causes for post-traumatic stress, and there was a list, and none of them seemed to involve me. I certainly wasn't in a war or a terrible accident, but it did mention sexual abuse, so I got a book on sexual abuse and found myself on every page. So I got into therapy, a couple of different therapists that were both skilled in sexual abuse. My biggest help was when I became a member of a men's survivor group in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was in that group for almost 4 years. They taught me things just by the way they treated me, and allowed me to, finally find a family. I also joined SNAP, the Survivor Network of Those Abused by Priests. This allowed me to be somewhat confrontational, so that was another part of healing. So if there are questions, I could answer them. I'm not a professional, but I hopefully can answer some questions.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. Hi, Bill. This is Rebecca. How are you?
Hi, Rebecca. Nice to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I just want to, follow up with Billy's appreciation for your bravery and willingness to come on the show today. We know that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so to have a survivor come on board to share your story and field any questions of callers that would come in is just amazing. So thank you for your time. So you said that you were involved in SNAP. Is that an acronym for something?
Yes, it's the Survivor Network of Those Abused by Priests. And that was in the Midwest section because I originally lived in Wisconsin, and the abuse that happened to me occurred in Wisconsin.
Is that something that's national and regional? Are there SNAP organizations throughout the country for our callers?
It is throughout the country. And I know that there are chapters probably in the Phoenix and maybe the Tucson area. I'm not active with them. I still stay in touch with Peter Isley, who is one of the founders of SNAP, and he's a Midwest director. So they keep me posted on some of the lawsuits that are going on, that kind of thing.
Right. Now, you shared that you started a healing journey in 1999, I believe you said.
Right.
And we very well could have other survivors who have not, crossed that bridge into healing and are still, holding things in and internalizing them with the, post-traumatic stress and depression that you have talked about. Do you feel that, and this, I'm saying this to be helpful to our listeners, do you feel that there was some memory loss and repression when you went into the healing journey? Did you remember more and more, or were you cognizant of everything that had happened the whole time?
I did lose a lot of memories, and I started to use, the talk therapy that I was using,
mm-hmm.
and I started to use self-hypnosis to get some of the memories back. I had certain points in my life that were terribly frightening, but I didn't know why. And I eventually was able to get into them. And to tell you the truth, I'm sure that there are additional additional pain that I haven't processed yet, but you know, I'm on my way. I'm over 70 years old, so I've got a ways to go, but I definitely have achieved some healing.
Right. And you're here with us today, which is just amazing. And again, we're so grateful for it.
Well, time I do this, it is healing for me to talk about these things. So that's a good thing.
And I empathize. I'm a survivor of domestic violence and attempted rape as well. So I understand. That's why I'm in the work that I do in advocacy, is because it was a part of a healing journey for me. So I empathize. And it is very hard to sometimes go on a national radio show and say things that have been painful for us. But the education piece is why we're here, and the prevention work to honor April as Sexual Assault Prevention Month. So I wanted to kind of turn this now towards the children. You had mentioned you were between the ages of 4 and 9, which is very young. Is there something that you would like to make mention of in your experiences of people that did you divulge what was happening to you? Maybe we could speak to parents here of how to listen to children and kind of go through that aspect.
Well, the things that I, you know, when I tried to tell, it made my situation worse, which is probably something that other survivors have experienced. It wasn't until I was an adult that I was actually able to, you know, reach some healing and, you know, talk therapy, and especially the group therapy with the men's survivor group was extremely helpful. Group therapy, I have found, is more difficult than one-on-one because, you know, you're dealing with other people, and it makes the whole process better but harder to do.
When you are in, this is a question that you can answer maybe vicariously through your group sessions, or speak personally, either is fine. But we had a chat room question regarding flashbacks. One of our callers would like to know, or listeners would like to know, if you have had any flashbacks and what triggers may have caused them for you or anyone in the group, other stories that you can share.
Well, I definitely had flashbacks, and they were sexual in nature, which was one of the clues I had that, you know, this was here. One of the flashbacks that I had was of a snake grabbing my penis, and that was very terrifying to me as an adult to have this flashback. I would have other flashbacks. For example, when I would brush my teeth in the morning and had a mouthful of toothpaste, I would have a mouthful of sperm instead. And so that was a flashback. I still have them, but I recognize what they are, and so they're not filled with as much fear. It's looking at it and saying, oh, that is fear in a flashback, and I'm able to point that out. Fear can sometimes just completely wrap us up and control us. And fear is just an emotion. I mean, I'm saying just. It's a terrible emotion, but I had learned to stand back from fear and say, well, that is fear. I can feel it right here. And it is helpful for me to understand where it was coming from.
Yes. And that is so important for any listeners that have not come forward yet, however long it may be, to hear you as a survivor who has you really reined in and you're understanding yourself and the triggers and the emotions, because we know what this trauma can do. It can lead to substance abuse, PTSD, depression, you know, and then also the cycle of abuse where survivors and victims become perpetrators. So the experience and surviving, especially at such a young age, I just really commend you for your bravery and strength. Not that it's a weakness if someone hasn't gotten quite to where you are yet, but this is why we're on the show, right?
That's correct.
So I'm wondering if you have any words of wisdom if we have listeners on that have not spoken about it, from if we were having a sort of, you know, blog talk radio group right now, what would you say to them?
Well, there was one thing that when it happened to me, it dumbfounded me. And I learned it from another survivor in the SNAP organization. And he would often make the statement, if the archdiocese would only put Father, whatever his name was, in jail, I'd be okay. And I learned that if the archdiocese doesn't put him in jail, I can still be okay. And I had to learn that. The other really striking thing that I learned was that even though I had this list of all these people that had harmed me, I found out who was responsible for my healing, and that was me. Now, you know, the justice that we have in us says, no, these people have to pay. They have to make it right. And, well, all of my abusers are dead, and I'm the only one that can make the healing happen. And that surprised me. I thought that, you know, other people and people who had victimized me could fix this. And I learned that very hard lesson that I had to do the healing myself.
Right. Exactly. And I wanted to share along those lines something that happened just today in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which I think is really important to share. Are you familiar with Jerry Sandusky and Joe Paterno?
Yes.
Here at Penn State? So
yes.
Today in the Capitol Complex, or the Hilton Harrisburg, a block from the Capitol Complex, Joe Paterno's wife came forward, which was a very, you know, debatable situation because, you know, Joe knew what was happening with the young children for so many years. But she, Joe Paterno's wife and her children came forward in a sexual assault networking conference to talk about how they felt guilty that they had given Sandusky all of the avenues to an access to these, basically on a platter, all of these young children, all these young
yes.
boys. And something that was very poignant in the conversation as I watched it on the news, that the son, who's very close to my age, I'm 37 years old, said, I didn't know anything was going on because I didn't know what to look for. If I would have had a training or if I would be more, if it wasn't so taboo and we could have this open dialogue as we're doing, he would know what to look for. So although you're not an expert, you are a survivor, so there comes with some, you know, you have the responsibility and you're sharing. What would an adult have noticed, do you think, in your youth, even though you had gone to certain people and asked for help and divulged what was happening? Do you feel like as a child you did show signs of what was going on? If so, would you like to share them for parents that are listening?
Well, I knew what was going on, but I buried the memories as a child. And so I had these blank incidences that I recognized. I knew they were there, and I knew that they had something to do with, for example, my first communion or my first confession. Excuse me. But I didn't actually have the memories until 1999. That was when I learned this by backtracking and through talk therapy and self-hypnosis. So I don't know if that answers your question, but, you know, when I did tell while it was happening, it only made it worse, and it gave other people opportunities to abuse me even more.
Yeah. Well, along with that, I think to continue on that path that parents always should believe their children.
Yes.
You have a very special, unique circumstance. Special is not a nice, I don't like using that word right now, but you have a very unique experience where you did tell your parent and your parent became a perpetrator that had abused you. We know that it's usually someone the family knows. You know, a lot of it happens in church settings, school settings, that parents and godparents ever doubt the children is telling the truth, investigate it. Go there, because it's very hard for a young mind to have a conflict with an adult that they're trying to divulge something that they don't yet understand. Always believe the children. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. The family and the subfamilies that were part of that were very toxic. I mentioned my grandfather, and I actually experienced him sexually abusing my mother when she was an adult. This was another memory that I got back. So, you know, to tell in that family didn't help. Eventually, I was, as an adult, I was telling therapists, I was telling the other men in my men's survivor group, and this helped me immensely. So, but it is, yes, parents should always believe the things that their children say. One of the problems that children have is that they don't have the vocabulary to describe what's happening to them. And they instinctively know it's wrong, but they just don't have the words. And so parents need to listen and hear their children and follow it up. And it's a very difficult thing to do.
Yes, and children also aren't aware of what's going on, so nor do they know what's happening is even wrong. There's a sense of discomfort that I think you can you could confirm that you knew that you didn't like it, but at the age of four, you know, the impact of what's happening, what do you gauge what's right and wrong at 4 years old? Other than, you know, obvious it's uncomfortable and, you know, not comfortable physically either. So, yeah, I'm switching. I apologize, everyone, and Bill, I'm switching phones. I've been told that I'm cutting in and out. Are you hearing me okay, Bill?
I'm hearing you, but I am noticing kind of a wavering. So if you switch phones, that would help me a lot.
Okay, great.
Yeah, that's better, I think.
So everyone can hear me clear now?
Much clearer.
Much better.
I think you were losing your battery.
I apologize.
That's okay.
Yep, that's exactly what was happening, and I even have it charged for a couple hours before the show. So I'm going to let Billy ask some questions now, and I just want to thank you so much, Bill, for coming on and enforcing this prevention work that we're doing together tonight.
You're welcome. I'm glad. I hope that, you know, part of my story can help someone to find healing.
Thank you
so much. This is Billy, and I just, you know, we've been talking in the chat room about how courageous it is for you to talk, and, you know, your work with SNAP and the rest of it, and so, you know, just thank you so much, and if you'd like to stay on the line, fine, or if you just want to listen in on the show, that's good as well, but we do appreciate your presence with us. We are honored by that presence. Rebecca, I'd like to turn now to what's happening in Indian country, both, you know, in the United States as well as in Canada with First Nations women in the world of sexual assault, crimes, et cetera. I know that the victimization of Indian women is very strong. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in Indian country for us?
Sure. There's, you know, a huge marginalization of justice and prevention work over the last, well, since 1492, to be honest. Over the last 30 years, the sexual violent prevention work and advocacy has really taken off beside the sisterhood of domestic violence work, particularly within the last decade and the last 5 years. There's been leaps and bounds regarding Indian country and breaking taboos and silence, as well as advocacy programs reaching into urban, rural, and reservation communities to discuss rape on the reservation. And I just quoted a very open, widespread film that was a documentary. I think it was on PBS or Current TV, Rape on the Reservation, which if anyone's interested in watching this documentary, which really gives the lay of the land, it's available on www.clanstar.org. It's posted permanently there. Clanstar is the national resource organization for sexual assault in Indian country.
Beth, can you give that website one more time for us?
Sure. It's www.clanstar.org.
Thank you. You know, when I think about this, and I am also a survivor of rape, and I, in the books that I read, and it's whether it is a historical text, whether it's talking about what led up to Crazy Horse's death, whether it's, you know, books that have been written by people who are leaders in Indian country now, this piece of sexual assault and domestic violence in Indian country is pervasive. It is there all the time. And I think about the races. I think about domination. I think about oppression. I think about genocide. What do you see today in your work as the root causes of sexual assault and domestic violence in Indian country?
Well, you know, I'll give my, you know, my personal opinion on it and also an academic scholarly report position on it. And if I could give one answer to it, it would be the boarding school experience.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about that for people who don't know.
Sure. The boarding school experience is intergenerational trauma that stems from Indian children being removed from their communities, whether it's reservation, agency, territory, or band location. They were removed to government-run or religious boarding schools where they were removed forcibly, given Christian names, beaten. You know, as soon as they came into the institution, they would be stripped of their traditional clothing. Their hair would be cut. They were no longer permitted to speak their language. So it was really immersion linguistic therapy, or not therapy, but, you know, they had to learn the language immediately by immersion. Children were beaten, jailed, incarcerated. You know, if a child was not easily manipulated into conformity, they would be put in asylums that were known as medical wards. So that was the ultimate punishment for a child who just did not want to conform. There was lots of abuse and rape, lots of, you know, the experience of not having anyone to speak to. You're being ripped from your parents and your grandparents and your, you know, wide family community, your Tawahe. And not having anyone to trust. So these students who went through all of these very horrible experiences had to grow up without those parental bonds, with no access to healing whatsoever. As those individuals grew up and continued, some of them returned to their tribal community or wherever they went in the world, they, much like Bill has described, had to go through some healing in order to be able to identify what was happening emotionally. Now, the boarding school, the original boarding school was the Carlisle Industrial School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and it closed in 1918. So we are well before the advocacy and programmatic, you know, opportunities for survivors to go through those healing processes. So what does that equal? Intergenerational trauma, cyclical abuse. When we're not healing, we're carrying. And then the caring individual becomes a parent. Not to say that every single person who has suffered abuse becomes a perpetrator, but statistically and emotionally with depression, substance abuse, and PTSD, that is quite often what happens.
Yeah.
So
go ahead, Beck. Sorry.
Oh, I say that because I'm very close in relation geographically and with my family to the Carlisle Indian School. So that is something that I understand, and I also have gone through a lot of conversations with tribal experts and researchers and traditional people who have confirmed that in their own words. So I think that's a pretty wide-based opinion.
Yes, I want people to understand that when we talk about the boarding schools and about the victimization that occurred there, we're not talking only, you know, if you will, ancient history. I attended the Wellbriety Journey when it came through Arizona a few years ago, and part of that experience is where people will come, Native Americans will come up to the mic, and they will share their experience as best they can. And I will never forget a woman who got up. And Rebecca, she only had the thumb and first finger on either hand, and the other three digits were they have been cut off. They have been chopped off by priests. And that was in relation to every time she fought back and did not want to be raped. And so they would remove one of those fingers. Now, this is a woman, and she wasn't an old woman. She was middle-aged. This was a woman that is alive today and had to go through that journey. And she talked about, too, as a young child, she was very young when this first started. I hate to say it, but she was 6 years old the very first time. And she talked about the fact that there, in her mindset, where was my mom? Where was my dad to come and save me? And so the victimization is not only physical, it's to the very soul. It's to the very soul.
Which is so painful to imagine for any child. And I'm going to, I want to give you a moment, Billy, because I know that that's very painful.
Upon them. I know, for instance, I know of Hispanic women and children, for that matter, who are being deported in the United States. And, you know, because I live in Arizona, this is part of my work and the day job. And we work with these women who are deported. They are picked up because they are what I prefer to say is undocumented immigrants to this country. They're picked up, and they're literally deported on the border at midnight or later. And then what happens is they're raped, they're mutilated, you know, once they're entering back into Mexico. It seems to me like there is such a motivation and such a level of violence against Native women. And I wondered, what was your experience in all of that?
Could you ask the question one more time?
There seems to be such a strong motivation to me when I hear about Native women and the violence, Indigenous women and the violence that's perpetrated against them. And I wondered if you had encountered that as well in your work nationally.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I kind of got lost there for a minute. Yeah. There is, you know, I think one thing to blame, and that has been jurisdiction. You know, and when I... Because there's very limited access for prosecution of non-Native perpetrators. And I can get into that in a little bit more, but the reality is the majority, 67% of reported sexual violence against tribal women are not investigated. So then we're running on a very small margin of less than a third that are even investigated. And then we can think about how many people do not come forward. So that third probably goes down to less than 10% in reality, you know. So the jurisdiction has exacerbated severely the rape and sexual abuse of Indian women. I'm going to share a story because I find that that's the best way to share the information for people to relate to. And I learned this from one of my conferences, Lucy Simpson. She's the executive director of National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, and they partner with PlanStar. And these amazing women, I joined at NCAI, the National Congress of American Indians, to receive an award for the Bawa Pass. It was like the biggest news, and we worked so hard for it. So I was with Lucy Simpson, and she shared the story of a Navajo territory. A woman was hitchhiking, went to get groceries, what have you, hiking down the road. Someone picked her up. She was brutally beaten and raped. She did get away. She ran to tribal police office. They got the guy before he left the reservation. Thank goodness, right? So he, you know, they were questioning him. She was given medical treatment. Yeah, this is what the man said. I'm paraphrasing, but yes, you can look in the back of my truck. The shovel's there. The duct tape is there. I have raped her. I was going to continue to do so, and then I was going to bury her in the desert. And he was let go because of jurisdiction. So on the grander scale, we're talking about prevention of sexual assault for all women, all boys, all girls, everyone on the globe is what we're really doing in the month of April to recognize this month. But when we're talking specifically about Indian country, we have to acknowledge that South Asia is no longer sex tourism, where we all know there's a black market. You have $20,000, $5,000, you buy an airline ticket, and you get a sex tour of pedophilia and rape with sex traffic victims. in Thailand, and that was kind of big in the 80s and early 90s. But this has been going on in Indian country because of sovereignty. Because when you cross that tribal land into a reservation or territory or agency, as a non-native person, those laws don't apply to you anymore. It's like being in a neutral Switzerland for sex, rape, pedophilia, et cetera. Whether, you know, again, we're talking about a 10% of investigation, let alone prosecution. So it has really been laws and treaties and sovereignty, along with, you know, the bravery that it would take for a tribal woman to come forward because it was once embarrassing and you didn't speak of those things. And that goes across all people of color and aspiring allies. It was taboo to speak of this for everyone.
Yeah, right? I know. It took me a long time before I would share about it or talk about it. And thank God for the Violence Against Women Act, and we'll talk about that and its impact in a little while. I'm wondering, you know, we were talking a lot about women here, and frankly, it makes me ill, the ease at which people could perpetrate crimes against women in Indian country. And that is why, you know, this particular topic and this particular demographic, it is different. It is different. But I wonder, what about the gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual community in Indian country and sexual assault? Do you find that the rates are just as high there? Are they higher? Are they, you know, what is happening among the gays and so forth in Indian country? Or is it even
being
tracked?
It certainly exists. It certainly does exist, and we know it does. That movement, that portion of the...
Hello, we're having some technical difficulty. Rebecca,
I'm back. I just came back, Brenda.
Okay.
Rebecca, are you there?
Here, I just called back in. Thank you.
Okay, good. Yeah, and we apologize to our listeners. This is on Blog Talk then, and we just don't have any control. Rebecca, you were talking about the presence of sexual assault among the GLTBQ community.
Yeah, so... it's really awesome news that, you know, there are LGBTQ programs opening up. We understand that it happens in all populations, more so within communities of color. It's really revolutionary and awesome that you asked the question and that there's answers for it today. There's been such a huge movement with trainings for, you know, the everyday advocate that is trained how to handle the LGBTQ population because there's struggles. They are the marginalized within a marginalized community of color. If a transgendered individual experiences rape or domestic violence and they go into a program, well, can a woman shelter the biological makeup of this woman who has the, you know, male genitalia? So there's a lot of movement going on, lots of problem solving, and the LGBTQ community was included in VAWA. So I just want to say that is so huge, right?
Oh, it's massive. And I know here in Arizona, we have a potential law on the books right now that bans the LGBTQ people from using public bathrooms, and it's something that I'm involved in at this Capitol, and it's just such a pain, and it's so horrible. And one of the things, 100 people at the hearing at the Appropriations Committee, and the thing that was so clear is that they don't want to tell anybody. They don't, you know, it's such a difficult lifestyle, and I think that makes them so vulnerable. It's totally understandable where they're coming from, but they're the most vulnerable population, and I would think probably, you know, another targeted, if you will, population.
Yeah, absolutely. The reality that if we're going to be honest and we're going to have an honest conversation, we have to acknowledge that communities of color are the marginalized populations that have been struggling for programs, culturally specific programs. And then within that marginalized population is another marginalization of being LGBTQ and or disabled. You know, that's another population that, you know, we want to add in to be, you know, all-encompassing. But the programs that are unmarginalizing them and creating equality is really on the mindset of every advocate in the country that we're all pushing to improve on.
Which is awesome. Yeah.
And right, I want to back up.
Let's go there. Let's say I've been assaulted and I have not been murdered in that assault, which is something we really haven't even touched on. But I've been assaulted. Mm-hmm. I survived that moment in time. What is my first step? Who do I call? What happens? You know, is someone going to take me from my home? Are the police going to come? If I'm a woman and I have children, are they going to take them away from the reservation? Are they going to give them to someone else? You know, what happens when I have that first moment of strength to say, by God, I need some help? What do I do?
Okay, great question. And it's going to have multi-tier answers, but I'll summarize and keep it short so we can, you know, address everything. It really depends on where you are. If you're in a public law 280 state, the public police department will be the 911 call that you make. If you're on a reservation that has a police station and a hospital or medical center, you'll want to call that police station. So step one would be to make sure you're safe and call the police. When you do so, you'll ask for a rape crisis advocate to meet you at the medical center, because one of the big things that is a part of our healing, as Bill described, is going through all the motions, including the conflict, wave of it, where you're going to move forward in your personal sovereignty and your safety. So what happens when you go to the medical clinic, unfortunately, it's a very uncomfortable and a brave moment for any man, woman, or child to go in for a safe exam. It's a sexual assault forensic examination. And this is the nitty-gritty of it, but I'm going to give an honest answer. You don't want to change your clothes. You do not want to shower. You want to go to the examiner's room with the ability to collect evidence. As caustic and toxic as that sounds after such an emotional event, that is what's going to maintain your safety, because some sexual abusers do repeat offend the same victim. So it's key to, if you do shower and you do go through those motions, to make sure that you put your undergarments and your clothing in a paper bag, not a plastic bag, because it maintains the evidence, the integrity of the evidence. When you go to a safe examiner or the hospital and you have that advocate that will help you answer and field questions and make sure that you're not bombarded, they're really an advocate and your best friend at the moment. They'll make sure that you're safe, help take care of your children, take care of everything. They'll also be there for you emotionally. If you need a counseling session on deck that moment, or you want to go ahead and prepare for the future and just have a face and a relationship right out of the gate with someone who can assist you. So, again, all of that greatly depends on where you are, because we could be on a reservation that does not have tribal police. It does not have easy access to a hospital that could be 90 miles away. So in that case, I would call a 1-800 hotline who can walk you through safety planning with the parameters that you have before you, whether it's distance or not having a car. This is one of the advocacy things that I offer, and you can reach me on Facebook if you need me, that I'll help you safety plan wherever you are in Indian Country. To get the help that you need, the way that you need the help, right?
Right. Again, and for our listeners, who is speaking is Rebecca Balog. That's B-A-L-O-G. She is on Facebook, and I can tell you that she means it when she says contact her on Facebook, and she will help you. She will do it. This is, you know, since I've known Beck, this has happened time and time again. And I also want to say and accentuate the shower piece. Rebecca, I know when this happened to me, I was in college. I was very young. pretty inexperienced, and the very first thing I did was shower. And I'm, you know, when I got back to my dorm, I showered and showered and showered. I had had a knife held to my throat the entire walk home from this guy's place, and all I wanted to do was get him off of me. And then the reality is somebody came and said, no, we've got to take you to the police. And of course it was the worst thing I could have done. But you just, it's such, you know, that's your first moment of courage when you can say, all right, I'm not going to shower, and I'm going to get help. You know that you've had your first victory over someone who has tried to destroy you when you can say, I'm not going to take that shower, and I'm going to get help, and I'm going to, you know, survive this. So thank you so much for that advice, because it really, really is just, it's just terrible. I know that, and I have grave concerns in the area. You know, you said a really good point when, you know, what if you're on the reservation and the closest hospital is 90 miles away? What if your family, you know, what if somebody tells you to go home and home is the place that is not safe, and you have another, you know, no other place to turn, and you literally have relatives saying, oh, well, you need to go back home. You know, you need to keep this quiet. You need to, how do you survive that?
Severe strength of women. Or men, you know, I don't want to I honor everyone, but the strength that and resolve that can come from an individual that is a survivor. And I have the highest respect and regard when I say the word survivor, because this is the, it, so much can be stolen from you if you choose to allow it. Mm-hmm. And that's the attempt. It's a power and control. Someone wants to take your power away from you. It is so hard, Billy. I'll be honest. I take crisis calls, and the situations that some women are in, there's no programs, there's no shelter, there's no police, or there's a family member on the police department, or the perpetrator will burn down and has. In fact, a couple of the people that I work with are family members, or their own homes have been burned down in retaliation. So there's a huge amount of work to do to have an easy answer that every woman who deserves to be safe is able to be safe. I get frustrated, and I have to admit I do hang up that phone as an advocate who can see my way through the call, and I hang up and I bawl my eyes out because I don't have a fix. Okay. So that crisis call turns into a counseling session with there's no direction at the end. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly frustrating. But because of VAWA, I'm hoping that a lot of that changes. So.
And, yeah, we're going to get to that because I think the impact is huge. And... it, you know, because we are an online radio piece, you know, that means hopefully that folks, if you don't have your own computer, you're listening to us through a phone or at a library or a community center, whatever. Again, you can reach Rebecca Balog, B-A-L-O-G, or even message Whisper and Thunder, and we will get you to Rebecca. I'm wondering, and you kind of alluded to this, Rebecca, while you were talking about the boarding schools and the resulting ripple effect. In the history of your work experience with sexual assault and domestic violence, how has that affected how Indigenous mothers raise their children? When they're a survivor, what do you see in terms of raising the children? And my hunch is it's the gamut. I mean, I think, you know, probably everything from overprotection to maybe some skill sets that are lacking to whatever. But, you know, the strength to even raise a child, just because you've been through this, to what they tell their daughters and sons about life, interpersonal relationships, trust issues, et cetera. I mean, what have you seen in terms of the impact when someone's assaulted and they have a family to raise?
Well, you said it. It's the gamut. You know, I don't want to make a blanket statement because it's so individualized. But, yeah, it goes from, you know, the emotional trauma and disconnect of being physically abused, that physical touch is incredibly uncomfortable, which we know is very nurturing to a child. So, you know, there's that experience. There is overprotection. I know a lot of families that will not send their child to public school because it's just too dangerous, even for school-age children in high school, that a lot of the perpetrators are that age. So it's across the gamut, the responses in child rearing. For me personally.
And if I know I've got troubles in this area, like if I know I just need some help, you know, because, in fact, a question just came in after the chat room. How many turn to drugs? How many turn to alcohol? You know, I mean, those you know, ways to self-medicate from the horrific pain. But if you know, what if I live in the middle of Pine Ridge, and there simply aren't services. Is there a way online to get some help? Is there, you know, what do I do when there's nobody to talk to?
And that is such a great question, and that is the wave of the future. And the benefit to this work is if you have a smartphone or a phone, landline, or a computer, you have access. You have access to assistance. You have access to counselors, parenting skills, advocacy. I do a lot of my advocacy 3,000 miles away from where the individual is. So with technology, everything is accessible. I don't know if that answers your question fully.
Yes, it does. And what we need folks to understand, I think, more than anything is there is help. There is a way. You are not alone. You are not alone. Reach out to us. We'll help to make a connection. Google, you know, Google is a wonderful thing. And just put in your question there. But, you know, and is it ideal if you can't get, you know, right in front of a counselor at the very second you need, you know, if you can't, no, it's not ideal. But there is help. You are not alone, because being alone, I think, is a re-victimization.
And so one other thing that one other thing that's really important for anyone that's listening that is thinking about reaching out, everything is absolutely confidential. I get it. I get what it's like in some of the communities where retaliation is almost as detrimental as the assault, because it can continue on and it can include your parents, your grandparents, your cousins, your best friend. The retaliation can be so toxic and fearful that women have left their communities because of the retaliation, because they did ask for help. So know that any advocate that works and is dedicated to the work that we're doing believes in full confidentiality, understands what it's like when someone says they're going to burn down your house, or that your family member may be put in a coma. Like, all of these things are examples that I have seen. So confidentiality and safety is number one. If you don't have that in your community, reach out. We're out here. We'll help you. You're not alone, because your community has perpetrators way too close to home to reach out, right? So I just want to make that clear.
Thank you. Thank you. It's such a good comment. Thank you. We've talked about men being assaulted. Do you find that American Indian First Nations men, are the rates of assault kind of the same as in the global community?
Yeah. I think it's about equal. The statistics show that women are assaulted more, and that's just a number. That's reality. However, men are in domestic violence situations, and men are raped by women. There's a lot of use of this language in custody hearings as well. So there's so many forms of abuse, right? And it's not all physical violence, because there are those people who think, no woman is going to be the man, or she's 5'4", he's 6'6", but I don't believe it. But the domestic violence is not just physical abuse. It's emotional, it's financial, it's neglect. There's many forms of it. So, yes, men are on
the... Repeat that for our listeners, because I do want to get that across. So many times when people equate domestic violence, they equate it to, you know, I'm being beaten, there's blood, there's bruises, I've been shoved into a wall, et cetera, and that is only one small portion of domestic violence. So could you accentuate that again, the different kinds of domestic violence?
Sure, yes. Domestic violence is physical, emotional. It can result in neglect, something that happens with family where you're cut off from your friends and family. You're not allowed to leave the house. There's financial abuse where you have a $10 a week allowance, or I make the money, you're the stay-at-home person. There's all kinds of abuse. There's the sexual piece. I think I covered the whole domestic violence wheel on that, but it is not just bumps and bruises. It is not just the black eye. You can vary, any one of us can be equally emotionally traumatized to receive and have the same depression.
I think sometimes that women feel if there isn't the bruising, if there isn't the blood, if there isn't, you know, that kind of thing, they feel compelled to stay in those relationships. They somehow don't make the bridge to, this is an abusive situation and I deserve better. Where do you think the pressures come from when women, you know, kind of, if you will, minimize the level of domestic violence and abuse. Why do they stay?
Well, you know, a lot of mainstream America and the world sees domestic violence, as we just said, the bruises, the black eye, the blood, and, you know, the physical violence. But if we back up and really take a look at what domestic violence is, the definition of it is someone taking your power. It's power and control. So when we have power and control issues, that's automatically an emotional response. So it gets minimized. You begin walking on eggshells. You become marginalized and subordinate in your home. And, oh, well, he does love me. He gives me breadcrumbs of affection, and he apologizes, and he bought me flowers and maybe even some diamonds or a new regalia or whatever it is that floats his boat to apologize. And then you just never know when you're going to get called a name or disrespected or, you know, any other things that can happen every day in our home. Women and families are sacred. Our partners are sacred. So we should be respectful to each other in our language, in our behaviors to each other for healthy relationships. Domestic violence isn't about physical assault only. If you don't feel sacred in your union in a healthy relationship, acknowledge the fact that it's just not healthy. And right there is the power and control.
Should I, I recognize that I'm in a bad situation, should I have a plan?
Safety planning is key, yes, yes. And not always for exit, because this is one of the things that we talk about in cultural competency. And in our, you know, there's, when the movement started, it was about building shelters. Quick, let's find a place for everyone to run away to. But that isn't always how our communities work. Sometimes we are dedicated to our family bonds. And for, you know, certain religions do believe that you are married, you have a union and a bond with this person that you try to work through to the fullest extent that you can until you have to make the choice, right? So I want to acknowledge that. But really working within our communities to prevent and educate and really to end domestic violence isn't fleeing. To end it is to start where it begins and heal what's going on with the perpetrator of the hurt person hurting someone else. Right? So, you know, I'm quoting my mentor here, Jalene Joseph from Native Wellness Institute. She does healing work all over the country. And one thing she taught me that I say as my daily affirmation, hurt people, and healed people, heal people. So that's something that's specific to Indian country. We want to heal our men. That's how we're going to stop it in Indian country. We're going to,
yes.
Men talking to men, right?
The history in Indian country, one of the things that I admire the most is restorative justice and how Native American First Nations people view justice in the whole. And so when one would look at, you know, a situation like this, it may not be the same way that, if you will, the white community would punitively go there, that I think in restorative justice we would also look at exactly what you said. We want to heal our men as well. I can tell you, Rebecca, in the chat room we've had a number of comments about the need for revenge. We've had a number of comments about how violence creates violence, and so therefore, you know, what about retaliation, and is it even possible to heal without justice?
Yes. And I'm going to go back to our first, you know, 10 minutes of the call that Bill, who was so gracious to come on and share his personal story, that his perpetrators are all gone. There is no justice for him. And he made that gift to us all to acknowledge that no one could heal him. Justice certainly helps some people, you know, and that's very individualized. But our healing is in our heart. We all need help to heal, but that's something that we can do without the justice. And we're talking about generations of Native women who have been victims of sex tourism and jurisdiction issues and treaty rights and men coming on the reservation and beating and raping our women and our children.
Mm-hmm.
And making it through to become generation makers now that are great-grandmas that have grandmas, great-grandmothers, and aunties that do love the youth in their community and the women that love and take care of each other properly. So they have been healing without justice for generations. So that's the best way I can answer that one.
As long as we're on that justice mode, I think one of the greatest victories to sovereignty, maybe the first one, was the recent passage of the Strengthening of the Violence Against Women Act. So can you kind of give us a summary of the act itself and what it's done, literally changed the future of justice in terms of sexual assault and both in adjudicatory response but also the rate of occurrence? Because I think it's going to have an impact on both.
Sure. So I'm going to summarize, but there's a lot of info to go through, but I really want to start with educating Indian Country and allies of what happened to jurisdiction, because we had it. It was a part of our treaties. You know how treaties are, you know, they give it, take it away, but we had sovereignty. We had jurisdiction over our land. What happened in the late 60s, early 70s, two non-Native men were drunk driving on the reservation and got pulled over by tribal police. They were incarcerated. Bam, there was a civil rights issue. No Indian is going to arrest a Caucasian person, because that's the situation that it was. That went all the way to the Supreme Court. Just being drunk driving on a reservation, getting incarcerated, ended sovereignty for all of Indian Country. That no non-Indian would ever be arrested on tribal land ever, no matter what. Unless the FBI would get involved if there was a homicide, you know, and if that was even investigated. But so that's what happened to our sovereignty. So what has happened just this year, just this February, VAWA was reauthorized to include tribal provisions, which restored for the first time ever our sovereignty and jurisdiction. It's a very small piece of the pie, however. It doesn't cross all criminal charges. It is specifically for intimate partner violence, meaning a non-Native man is on the reservation, is in a meaningful is pretty relative, but is in a relationship with length, either lives with her, has been there, has had children with her. It has to be a relationship. If there's sexual assault in that relationship or domestic violence, now, since we have our jurisdiction, we can prosecute that individual. So there's been a lot of misinformation going around. There's been a lot of assumptions. There's been a lot of backlash from Indian Country regarding this, because it is such a very small percentage of people that will be covered, because the Indian Country in question where this would take place has to have certain criteria to even be applicable for VAWA. So, you know, it's not the grand coup that we would like to have, but it's certainly the first foundation to restore jurisdiction across all of the other facets of criminal activity. Right. So I hope that kind of explains that.
It does.
In summary.
And we have to remember sovereignty is an inherent right. It isn't anything that anyone has to earn or be given. And, you know, this is the greatest injustice of all in Indian Country today. We have a caller with us. For right now, I'm just going to call her R, and if she wants to self-identify her first name, that is up to her. But I know that she would like to talk with us, and she is a reader and contributor to Whisper and Thunder. So, Brenda, if we could open up that mic. And is she there? Hello?
Oh, I hope she's on.
Yes. Okay, well, tell you what, if you're on and Rebecca and I are talking, go ahead and interrupt and say I'm here. In the meantime,
yes, please.
Are you there, R? Okay, not yet. In the meantime, Rebecca, I was wondering, I feel that the passing of VAWA will impact rate of occurrence. Is that your thought as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the goal. That's the goal of this, is not to incarcerate men, because, of course, we want to work on prevention and ending violence, not band-aiding it. But the accountability factor is there. with the man in Navajo country who had the duct tape and a shovel in the car, this wouldn't necessarily apply to him because it's not intimate partner. However, for all the individuals that are doing economic abuse and domestic violence, especially with custody of children for affluent tribes with casino money, you know, this has been a shopping ground for snagging an Indian woman who's got a big stipend from the casino, have a couple kids with her, steal the kids, beat her up, and there's no price to pay. That's a local trend that's emerged, unfortunately, with economic justice. But, yeah, that guy, we can stop now.
Exactly.
Right?
We can stop. And it's amazing. Now, I know our caller's mic is open. Caller, are you there?
This is Renee. I don't know if you're talking to me.
We are, Renee.
Hi.
Welcome to the show this evening. You've got Billy and Rebecca online with you. I know that you wanted to share with us, Renee, so go ahead and do that.
All right. Well, Russ knows, and Billy, I think, knows my story, too. I am a survivor. From the time I was 8 to 15, my stepfather abused and raped me, you know, whenever he pleased. It wasn't just when he pleased. It would be when my mother was asleep in the middle of the night. So when that happens to a child when they're that young, it takes all, I mean, you're afraid for the rest of your life at night. I don't sleep at night. It's hard for me to sleep. And these things are lasting throughout your whole life. I mean, my God, I'm 71 years old, and that was so many years ago. But it's still with me. That one lady that said she couldn't wait to wash him off her, taking a bath and scrubbing, that's what I have done all my life. It ruined my marriage with my husband that married me when I was 15 to get me away from what was happening to me, but with my stepfather. But there has to be some mental help for these kids, too. However, if they catch these men and put them in jail or whatever that they do to them, it's past the fact, but at least that will give the kids something that they can't continue doing that to them, you know.
Mm-hmm. That is such a great point, you know, and I want to go back to the Sandusky just because it's so publicized. Believe the children, right?
Yes.
Did you make any attempts to tell anyone when you were younger, Renee?
He always carried a knife, and he was always sharpening that knife, and he told me, every day while he's sharpening a knife, if I told he would, when he got out, he would hunt me down, find me, and split my neck from ear to ear. And believe me, I beat him. You know, he was a scary man. I mean, other men were afraid of him. Our next-door neighbor knew that he was beating us up. And he told us years later he was ashamed of himself for not stepping in and trying to help us. But with him beating my mother, and my mother was just a 5'2", and I'm 5'8", at that time, all I could do was, the only thing that kept me going, I guess, is that I protected my mother with the beatings that he was giving her for what, anything. I don't know. She could say she got home late from work, and there would be, him. I think the men themselves are, they hate themselves. I mean, it's taken me all these years with help to look at it objectively from another point of view, from not being just the child that it was happening to, but I'm observing what made this person do this to me. I was just a little girl when he married my mother. I mean, why? Why? And when I think back, I presume his mother did not like him either. I don't know. I mean, she must have had good reason, but in any case, that's no excuse for any of the men on the reservations for doing what they're doing. I have a relative now that is writing a book, We All Descend from Chiefs, and she said this wasn't a case, because it happened to her too, a family relative. We're not alone. This is happening to some little child right now, And it just infuriates me that I can't do something to help that child. I got no help, but the only thing that kept me going was my hatred for him. I mean, I hated him. And that's what kept me going through the next day to the next day. It was the strength. I got the strength from myself. I had nobody else that I could until I kept running away, and finally he was gone. And then my mother, the police brought me back, and my mom said, "Why do you keep running away?" So I thought, I don't care if he slits my throat or not. I'm telling my mother, I've got to get out of here. Please let me out of here. And that's what finally happened. You know, I did tell my mother. And, of course, she said, well, she wouldn't. She was ashamed. She didn't want me to tell my aunts or anybody. I mean, at the time, it hurt me. But now I can understand, being a mother myself. It's shameful. Like you said, the women are shamed when their child comes to them and tells them this is happening to them.
I don't know if Bill is still on the line or not, but I know with Bill, he tried to tell four different times. And I know, different to when I was raped in college, this is Billy, but my mother was very abusive. And I remember after she died, I said to my father, why didn't you help me? Why didn't you intervene? Why didn't you stop the electric shocks? Why didn't you stop the horse whip? Why didn't you stop? And he said, Billy, I had to live with her too. And I wonder, you know, just for the sake of a so-called, in quotes, peace in a family, how many people turn away from the intervention? And it's what Rebecca said. Always listen to the child, always believe the child, and be there for that vulnerable child who is simply not strong enough, you know, to save themselves. And then the other piece, which Bill brought out, and I know Russ Litica brought up in our chat room, Bill was abused from the time that he was a little boy, you know, right on up. I think children don't necessarily know what to say or how to say or what the words are, and you have to look at those children's behaviors and think, why? You know, why is this child behaving the way they are? Renee, I do know you have a beautiful daughter. Do you feel, how did this impact how you raised her?
Oh, my gosh. I was a bookkeeper up until she was born, and I stayed home. I managed apartments, and so I could stay home with her. I mean, I was there with her until she was 5 years old. I only would let the man, my stepfather, died. He's dead. And my mother said that the house, it's been new carpeting. It's been painted. There's no trace of him ever being there. So I was able to go back to that house. But it took me years and years, almost 10 years, before I could see my mother again or even go into that house again. But anyway, it was his son and his daughter married, and we became close, my sister and I, half-sister. And it was her husband, believe it or not, that molested my daughter. I let her out of my house for one night to spend the night at my sister's, who lived across the street from me. And that son of a bitch, excuse my language, but put his fingers in her, you know? I mean, she was a little girl, a little teeny five-year-old. I could kill him right now if he was in front of me. So that's why my daughter and I live together, because we are strength for each other. I protect her now,
right,
and she protects me.
Right.
We don't
exactly
trust men. We just, it's a shame that we'll, you know, we'll never find love or the normal love that a woman finds or looks for. We're afraid to. So,
right.
Well, thank goodness she's a strong girl and I'm strong. But it is a shame, because I know I'm not alone. There's many, many little girls out there that this is, and little boys that this is happening to, that they lose trust. They don't have anybody that can help them,
right,
you know,
right,
and be be there for them. I was there
Renee,
for my mother.
I know that our guest, Bill, is still on with us. And, Brenda, if you could open up his mic, please. As victim to victim, you know, Bill has found love. His abuse was horrible. Bill, I'm just wondering if you would have something to say to Renee. Bill, are you there?
And while we're waiting for Bill to come on, Renee, I want to say something.
I guess I don't know Bill. Do I know Bill?
No, but he was
can
on
you hear
our
me?
Show earlier this
oh,
evening.
Oh, there you are.
Yeah,
oh, yes.
I'm here.
Bill, what would you say to, have you been able to hear Renee and her story?
Yes. I felt the way you did, Renee, that it just couldn't be possible to find love. And I just lived my life, and I thought, well, I'll just, you know, do things like go fishing and that kind of stuff, and I won't find it. But I believe that by achieving healing, I made myself ready to find that. I think as long as we stay sick, we can't find it. We'll find sickness. And if we get healthy, we'll find healthy. And so I do think that it's possible, even though it seems so remote and far away.
And Rebecca, what would you say?
I would go back to hurt people, and healed people. And what I'm hearing is your mothering. You have taken a stance to heal your daughter and be there. And I just want to acknowledge to you and have you acknowledge to yourself that you are that healed person healing someone else.
Yes.
Doesn't make it not hurt occasionally. You know, it comes back, right? But you are a healed woman and a very strong one.
Yeah, my ribs were broken and my nose was broken, and those things I still look in the mirror or I put a bra on, and it's a physical reminder. The mental reminder is me always having to wash my hands. I very seldom leave my house because nothing is clean to me other than my little world here. So that part of me is, well, it's obsessive compulsive disorder. And I don't know if I got that through what happened to me, and if my daughter has it now because I have it, had it, or still have it.
Yeah.
I don't know but we both have, you know, that obsessive compulsive disorder by washing things off of us. If somebody sneezes, you know, we both run the other way and, germaphobes, pretty much. But yeah, we get by life through our sense of humor. Thank goodness, I have a sense. Mm-hmm. Most Indians do have a sense of humor, as we can laugh at ourselves. And I guess that's how I'm still here, and try to help my daughter. And both of us, of course, we're both cancer survivors in the past year. I probably through stress that we ended up with. Both having cancer within the last year.
Well, congratulations on beating cancer.
Yeah, we're survivors
my
of that
goodness.
Too, and we're both strong women. And my daughter's, she's worked her way up in the hotel business to where she's, you know, was a financial controller. You know. So we're not dependent on men or a man to help us to live.
Well, and Renee, that's probably a whole nother show for young women out there in terms of not dependent on a man and vice versa.
The children have this happening to right now. I think it could be the men are so disgusted in themselves that they drink. I've talked to several of my brothers and their pain that they're feeling now. And I could see where, no one's ever said that they have a child or a child that they're abusing. But I try to read between the lines to see if I can help another little child that this might be happening to.
Right.
But I can see.
And that,
our brothers are hurting. They can't make enough money to take care of their families. The ones that do, many of them, just impregnated women and they're gone. The women go back and live with their families. And most generally, it's the grandmothers that end up taking care of the children from such a union, you know. But
and I think that I want to comment on that it does take a village and that we all need to take care of each other. We need to be aware of what the signs are for abusers and little victims, little survivors, and
adult
ones.
Yeah, because they're trying to reach out. I was only lucky that my teacher at school, from my black eyes and my bruises she could tell I was being beaten up, and she just called me into her office and that was how she called my mother and said, if something isn't done, I'll take her away from you. And then that's when my mother let me marry my husband.
I think
thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, the wounds are so deep. We've heard Renee tonight. We've heard Bill tonight. And I commend both of you for your courage in speaking up. And, you know, Renee in particular, because I know where Bill is at in his life and his journey, you I don't know as well. But I do know that, Renee, take it within you, the courage that it took to come forward tonight, that it, you know, takes to come and talk publicly, and I'm just so grateful. Rebecca, I hear these wounds, and I hear the level of pain, and I know the depth to which these assaults have traveled within their journey, and what I'm wondering is how do you learn to trust again? How do you learn to trust yourself, your others, you know, that are in your life, your own personal judgment? How do you learn to trust?
You have to trust yourself first.
Rebecca, if you could, you know, kind of address that, and, you know, because I know you work with this professionally, how do people learn to trust again?
It is very individualized. I think Renee had a great starting point to answer that question, is that acknowledgement. A lot of it does come deeply within facing the realities of it and, you know, owning it as a sense of just life experiences, that it does not define who we are. Our assaults don't define us. They are just, a portion of our lives that, as with everything else, a lot of injustice and unfair and disrespect, but as we go through our lives, acknowledging it internally and working on healing ourselves. If we could say an affirmation every day that I will heal myself from the experiences that come before me, that's the first step. And that crosses every bridge, whether it's substance abuse or alcoholism or domestic violence, sexual assault, or someone, you know, you lost your job today. It still encompasses as a self-care piece. So to build trust really starts within ourselves. No one can advocate for that. No one can necessarily counsel that into us. It's our self-preservation that really is key.
Yeah.
And I hear
closing
that from Bill.
Closing thoughts?
You know, great example.
Closing thoughts from anyone?
Well, I wanted to thank you, ladies, for what you're doing. It's Renee. I wanted to thank you for all that you are doing and to help some little child that this is helping to get help for that, so it won't continue to happen to them.
Well, you're welcome. It's our humble honor. Bill, do you have any closing
thoughts? Thank you, Renee.
Well, I think it's very important for people to talk about it. And we have been on Whisper and Thunder Radio tonight talking to each other about sexual abuse and, domestic violence. And it's important for people to learn to talk to other people about it, talk to people they trust. And I think, you know, we're modeling that, and that's a good thing.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Just so very grateful to have the opportunity to speak to all the wonderful people on the phone today, and very happy for the listeners that came on and invested their time, that we can really end this violence in our communities.
Well, thank you, everyone, so much. This is an important show. We're seeing on the chat room several people are saying thank you, you know, so much for doing this. spread the word of this show. It'll be on our archives. Most importantly, we want you to know that there is a place to turn to. There is someone who will listen. Rebecca has offered her services this evening. She said contact her through Facebook. So anyone who is on Facebook, anyone who hears us, if you have access to Internet and then to Facebook, if you search Rebecca Balog, that's B as in boy, A-L-O-G, or if you message us at Whisper and Thunder, we will get you in touch with Rebecca. She is a professional in this area, and she will be able to help you. Brenda, I think we'll turn it back over to you, and we'll close out this evening. We want to thank everyone for listening to Whisper and Thunder this evening. We will be back on in a couple of weeks. Russ Litica will be talking and hosting that particular show. So, Brenda, I'm going to turn it back over to you now, and thank you, everyone, so much. I'm not hearing Brenda, but I'm going to say good night. All right, guys, take care, everyone. Good night.
All right, good night.
Good night.
Good night.